Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
10% unemployment, 10.2% to be precise. I think everybody knew it was coming, just not so soon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Friday, everybody. It is the 6th of November, which makes it 23 months since the recession officially started. The folks who set that date, the National Bureau of Economic Research, they picked it in part because December of 07 was the last month in which this economy had a net gain in employment. Since then, we have lost 8.5 million jobs. The unemployment rate hit 10.2% last month, and pretty much any way you slice it, this is the worst job market this country has seen in 26 years. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the silver linings are hard to find.
In October, American employers eliminated 190,000 jobs. Not good at all. But compare that with the rate the U.S. economy was shedding jobs 6 months ago, and this is a sea change.
Oh, definitely, definitely. If you look at the data over the last 3 months compared to the last year, clearly the job losses are getting smaller. Some sectors like education and health are actually adding jobs.
John Sylvia is chief economist at Wells Fargo. But Sylvia was still surprised by the big jump last month in the unemployment rate.
It does suggest that there's a lot more structural challenges out there in terms of job creation in the U.S. economy than I think many people expected.
Sylvia worries that economic growth alone may not put millions of Americans back to work, that some jobs in construction or manufacturing may not come back.
So there seems to be a big mismatch of skills in American society for the jobs that are available.
A former construction worker, for example, can't just jump into a job in healthcare. Dean Baker's at the Center for Economic Policy Research.
What that means is we're probably going to continue to see the unemployment rate rise further. And the really discouraging part is we're probably not going to see the unemployment rate start to come down until as soon as probably next summer. So we're looking at a pretty bad story there.
Baker says the one bright spot is that firms added 44,000 temporary workers last month. But so far, there's no sign they're going to make those employees permanent anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
If you can remember back to the labor market of 1983, then recalling the global economy circa 1998 shouldn't be too hard. Investors with long memories shiver when they hear the phrase Russian debt from back then. A lot of people lost their shirts 11 years ago when Russia defaulted on its national debt. So there were some questions this week when the Russian finance minister turned up in London and started talking about his plans to issue almost $18 billion in bonds next year. Until not too long ago, the very idea of Russia issuing new debt would have raised some eyebrows. The idea of investing in it might have been considered insane, but that does seem to be changing, as Ashley Montite explains.
Russia has shied away from issuing international debt for years, so why return to the stage now? Saleh Daher is managing director of investing group Turan Corporation. He says Russia entered the financial crisis months ahead of other countries.
So they had to spend an awful lot in their stimulus program, so this is basically to fund the stimulus program.
He says Russia doesn't want to build up budget deficits. It would rather borrow. Daher says Russia rocked financial markets 11 years ago when it defaulted on its debt, but bond investors have short memories.
This is once again a time when people are desperate for returns. Therefore, there is huge appetite for Russia, which is going to come in, you know, a little bit over 2% above what U.S. Treasuries yield for the same maturities.
He says investors are sick of looking at their money market accounts and seeing next to no interest coming in. And they're betting Russia is on a roll as the price of oil rises. Other commodity prices could follow. But Joel Kurtzman of the Milken Institute says there's far more to be wary than excited about when buying Russian debt. He compiles a list of countries in order of risk. Russia comes 35 out of 49.
Corruption levels are very high. The legal system is barely functioning. The accounting standards are pretty poor, and the regulatory structure is almost non-existent.
He says things may look rosy for Russia in the short term, but the government issuing those bonds has serious problems. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Let's go from Russia to retail now. The online pricing war between Walmart, Target, and Amazon continues. This week's victim? DVDs. Walmart said yesterday it would lower the price of some popular discs to $10. The point being to lure customers to the website to buy those DVDs at a discount, hoping they will buy other things while they're there. So in response, Amazon is now offering DVDs at $9.99. So, of course, Walmart came back with $9.98. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York on the difference a penny makes.
The thing about companies like Walmart and Target and Amazon is they sell enough products in enough categories that any loss they take on a book or a DVD can easily be made up for when they sell a grill or a big screen TV. But then why stop at $9.98? Why not go down to $9.95 or $9.50? Here's Jeff Dotson, who teaches marketing at the Owen School of Management at Vanderbilt University.
These companies are already operating on relatively thin margins. And so if you think about a product that's going to sell, you know, a million copies, right, a penny per copy is a pretty substantial hit to these firms.
Although for Walmart, that would be $10,000 for a company that just did $100 billion in sales last quarter.
The penny compounded, if they sell enough, obviously can make a small difference. The real point is in messaging.
That's Frank Luby, a pricing expert at Simon Kucher & Partners. He says each of these companies wants to be known as the lowest-priced retailer, and they've got to prove it with every item. Raul Vasquez agrees, and he should know. He's the CEO of Walmart.com.
Every penny matters because it's about trust with the customer. We are going to have the lowest price. So if someone matches us at $10, we'll go down to $9.99. If someone matches us at that price, we'll go down to $9.98 because it's about trust.
That's especially important as retailers like Walmart compete to lure customers to their websites for what's already turning out to be the biggest online shopping season ever. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Maybe Wall Street saw a different set of unemployment numbers than the rest of us. I don't know. The major indices rose today a little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Maybe the toughest part of today's unemployment report to wrap your brain around is that there aren't a whole lot of places that 10% of the workforce that's not working can go. Companies aren't really hiring. Not many new jobs are being created. And commentator Charles Handy says the thing to do then is to make your own work.
Let's be realistic. Jobs are going to be in short supply for the next few years. Of course, it does depend on what you mean by a job. The other day, I was having lunch with an advertising executive. He was bemoaning the fact that he had lost his job while still at the height of his powers, as he saw it. Just at that moment, the electrician who was working in his house put his head around the door. "I won't be back for a couple of days," he said. "I've got another job to fit in." In his world, a job meant a client. In my friend's world, it meant an employer. There's no obvious limit to the number of electrician-type jobs that can exist, or plumbers, or accountants. The world is full of potential clients for something. The problem is that you have to create the something yourself, and most of us are not born entrepreneurs, particularly if we've grown up and even grown old in institutions, moving from school to college to organization, places where work is shoved at you, yours only to pick up your shovel or pen and deal with it. It's best to practice it young, if you can. I said to my kids, "When you leave college, don't get a job at first. Find someone who will pay you money for something you make or do for them. It'll be good practice for life later on. But it's never too late to start, and more of us will have to one day, now that life is longer and organizations much slimmer. I did it. I became fed up with organizations, grew out of them really, and went on my own when I was 49. Cold calling potential clients, learning to live a cash flow life after a salaried one. It was hard at first. But I learnt to love the freedom and the joy of working with people rather than four people. Besides, if you are your own boss, it's up to you how hard you work, or where, or when, or why.
Management consultant Charles Handy is a founder of the London Business School. His most recent book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Today was one of those days when you realize how difficult it can be to measure something as complicated as the American economy. As we said up at the top of the broadcast, the October unemployment rate came in a good deal worse than expected today. Yet the economy is officially growing, and the recession is, technically anyway, over. Here to help us make sense of it with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond is Felix Salmon from Reuters, also Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Likewise.
Felix, I forget exactly what your blog post was titled this morning about the unemployment numbers, but it really depressed me. So elucidate, would you?
10.2%, I think, was the headline on that thing, which is all you need to know. It's absolutely gruesome. We're in double digits. The level of unemployment is so incredibly high that we're never going to be able to raise interest rates for the foreseeable future. That means that the dollar is going to remain weak. That in turn means that the rest of the world is going to have second thoughts about lending us trillions of dollars a year to fund our twin deficits. That in turn means that this weird sort of unsustainable set of global imbalances is eventually going to come to an end. And since the global financial system barely exists in any kind of coherent way, there's no way that the G20, the IMF, or anyone else is going to be able to stop
a catastrophic explosion,
and the end of the world as we know it.
Oh, man. All right. So Lee Gallagher now gets the toughest question I think I have ever posed, ever.
Uh-oh.
Lee, you got to make us feel better somehow.
I don't know
there?
If I can do that, Kai, honestly. I mean, it's not all negative. October retail sales were a lot better than anyone thought. We had John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, coming out this week and saying that the recovery was well underway and that their revenue is going to go up. But really, this 10.2%, this is worse than what most economists forecast for the peak. And, you know, they forecast that sometime next year. So this is really bad. It was a surprise. And I think it shows just how out of sync all the rallies are that are happening around the globe in every asset class with what's actually happening on the ground.
Well, they're not rallies, they're bubbles, you see. This is the thing, that you're borrowing money very cheap in dollars because interest rates are zero and you can then invest it in anything you like. And so every asset class around the world, whether it's bonds or stocks or commodities, is all going up. But it's not because it's worth more. It's just because money is free.
All right. But hold on. So we talked about the whole bubble thing on the show earlier this week, and I don't disagree with any of that. But let me bring another number to your attention here, that 3.5% growth in GDP that we got last time GDP was recorded. Anyone?
You can argue, and many people are doing this, a lot of that growth is due to the stimulus and due to the money that's being flooded into the system, and that real growth, in other words, real people buying more stuff and spurring kind of real economic demand, is still not happening the way it would were none of those policies put into place.
Okay, so Felix, what has to happen?
Well, one of the things that needs to happen is that the U.S. needs to bring down its borrowing internationally. Another thing which needs to happen is that China needs to significantly increase its own domestic demand so that China can, to a large extent, replace the U.S. as a source of demand for global goods. Is that possible? I have no idea.
The president came out this morning talking about the jobs numbers, and he said, "I will not rest until every American who wants a job can have a job." Is this now, Felix, Obama's economy?
Not yet. No,
still,
he hasn't
really
had nearly enough time to turn this into his economy. He's been putting out fires for the past year and will be putting out fires for the next couple of years. I don't think he owns this economic crisis quite yet. You can't blame it all on him. He, in fact, you know, pushed through a $789 billion stimulus bill, without which, undoubtedly, as Lee said, we would not have seen that 3.5% GDP growth. So he's doing what he can, but he is clearly not going to rest for the remainder of this term, because there's no way that you're going to get anything like full employment until the next presidential election.
Lee, is this his economy yet, or is it still the Bush administration?
I don't think so. I think we're still dealing with legacy problems. I mean, the unemployment is a result of the financial crisis, which is a result of the lack of regulation that really led up to everything that happened in 2008. So I don't think just yet.
Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, jockeys ride a new wave of popularity.
We really did it for the good of the game to, you know, try and get new fans out here and try and keep the existing fans out here and just try and keep people coming out.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials tacked on a 0.1% today, 17 points, closed at 10,023. The NASDAQ picked up a 0.3%, 17 points, finished at 21,12. The S&P 500 popped up a 0.25%, that is 2 points, finished at 1,069. For the week, yes, it is Friday, the Dow picked up 0.3%. The S&P 500 also picked up 3.2%. The NASDAQ finished ahead 0.3%. Several stocks got a big boost after analysts upgraded them. General Electric shares juiced up more than 6% today. Amazon booked a 4.75% gain. The Travelers climbed 2.5% after Goldman Sachs upgraded that insurer to a buy. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.5%. That's 3.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. American Public Media presents Rising by Degrees, an American Radio Works documentary supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org. Want to know how to talk money with your tykes, tweens, and teens? Get tips on the Marketplace Money website. And to learn more about your child's financial future, stay tuned for our Marketplace Money's upcoming live show in Portland, Oregon.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Monday. The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in two cases about whether imprisoning a juvenile for life without the possibility of parole for a non-homicide offense is cruel and unusual punishment. Comedian George Lopez debuts a new late-night talk show, and it's the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. The concrete divide came tumbling down 20 years ago. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You've got your media superstars, you've got your business moguls, and then you've got Oprah. She practically created a category all her own, which is why reports she might leave broadcast television are being taken seriously. Speculation is that the Queen of Daytime will take her show to her new cable channel, the Oprah Winfrey Network, OWN, O-W-N. Oprah said she will decide by the end of this year if she is saying bye-bye to broadcast. So we have called Bill Carter from the New York Times to talk about the risks and rewards such a move might entail. Bill, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Kai.
This rumor about Oprah going to her own network has been around for a while. Any more weight to it now?
Well, I think the fact that she actually has started up a cable network gives it a little more credibility. I mean, you have to remember, though, that Oprah, each time her contract comes up, seems to put out the word that she's either going to stop doing it or move somewhere else or something like that. So she has a history of kind of using this as a negotiating ploy. In this case, it's a little different, though, because she really does have this this new outlet to go to.
If she does go to her own network, what happens to those she left behind? It's the CBS distribution group and then those ABC stations who air her every day.
I think they're both going to be hurting. I mean, you know, the CBS syndication does not have anything anywhere remotely as profitable as the Oprah Winfrey show, so it would be impossible to replace it. I think it would have tremendous impact at ABC because they've always had Oprah as their late afternoon lead into local news, which has helped the ABC network newscast as well. There's no other show that can replace that, the 7 or 8 million viewers that Oprah brings every week. And in terms of just sheer advertising revenue, I think they'd take a very big hit. So there'd be a significant loss.
Not that she necessarily needs any more money, but what about herself personally?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing about Oprah is there's no way to calculate how much money she's made. It's just so extremely huge. But I think she also likes being a big player on the, you know, the national and the cultural scene. And she would have to weigh the impact of moving to cable because, I mean, she's had a very hot year getting people like Whitney Houston. She's got Sarah Palin coming up with her new book. And, you know, she gets those guests because of the power of her show. And you'd have to wonder if she would get them if she was on cable. She's still Oprah. She's still going to get big people. But her profile would definitely be diminished. A lot of people have brought up the Howard Stern example, right, saying he was a national figure on radio, went to a small outlet, and now seems to have very little impact. I don't know if that would be the same with Oprah. She's a real crossover figure, but I think it might give her pause.
Is she big enough, do you think, to get people to subscribe to cable just to get her show?
It's not the question of people subscribing to cable, because there's plenty of people that subscribe to cable, so that's plenty of reach. The problem is a lot of people have decided, oh, I'll go into cable, I'll start a channel, and they get on the digital tier and nobody ever watches them. So I think she'd have to be concerned about that.
What about the upside for ABC and CBS? I mean, it's got to be expensive, right, for them to buy this and distribute it and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, but they're obviously – look, it's very expensive. Oprah takes the biggest chunk for herself, as she should, but they're all making money. They've been making a lot of money off Oprah for all of this time. And believe me, if they weren't making money on it, they wouldn't be so afraid to lose her. You know, it came up in an earnings call of CBS Corporation yesterday. It was a second question. What happens if you lose Oprah Winfrey? It's really important to them.
Bill Carter covers television for The New York Times. Bill, thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
Some of the most promising thoroughbreds in the world are here in Los Angeles for the Breeders' Cup this weekend. But the prospect of a good horse race isn't enough to fill the grandstands out at Santa Anita. The track has had to cut ticket prices by as much as 50%, down to just $10 for general admission. Racetracks all around the country have been fighting declining attendance for years. Now those tracks are betting on the little guys to help them launch a comeback, as Andrea Gardner reports.
In horse racing, the star athlete has long been the horse. Think War Admiral and Secretariat, legendary names in the sports world. The men and women riding the horses have generally been unknowns. But if jockeys have it their way, soon you'll not only know their names, you'll want to see them in person.
We got autographed.
Excited, aren't you?
I asked him if he could sign it, and he said yes, and it was really cool.
9-year-old Rachel Free and her brother Kobe are at the Santa Anita racetrack outside L.A., and they're downright giddy over meeting jockey Joe Talamo. The kids watch him on a reality show called Jockeys. The TV program airs on Animal Planet and offers a glimpse at the drama both on and off the track. In this moment, Joe is chosen to ride the Kentucky Derby favorite, and a friend tells him to watch his back.
There's not one rider that wouldn't like to be in your position.
We're all like vultures.
The reality show stands to change the public perception of jockeys. More than just little people in colorful silks, they're what racing aficionados know them as. World-class athletes in a cutthroat sport. Talamo is getting used to the fanfare.
I really did it for the good of the game to, you know, try and get new fans out here and try and keep the existing fans out here and just try and keep people coming out.
Talamo made a recent appearance on The Tonight Show. He has a following on Facebook and Twitter. And he's only 19, which means he could easily ride for the next two decades. Many hope he'll breathe new life into a sport that definitely needs reviving. After all, racing's core customer, gamblers, have replaced the track with simulcasting and off-track betting, says sports marketing expert Joe Favorito.
What it used to have was kind of, if you wanted to go and bet on horses or you wanted to go and understand horse racing, you had to go to the track. And now you obviously, that's probably the last of your options and is actually physically going to the track.
Favorito says the key to rejuvenating the sport is pairing a popular jockey with a champion horse. But nowadays, it's near impossible for a horse to do what Seabiscuit did, becoming a household name by thrilling people year after year. That's because horse owners make more money in breeding than racing. So top horses are typically retired after only 3 years, just as they're hitting their stride.
It's a very, very short window to be successful. And when they're successful, it's usually kind of towards the end of their career. So as much as the horses kind of come and go, the jockeys are always there, and the jockeys help make the horses what they are when they are successful.
Favorito says a superstar horse would do more for the sport than a popular jockey. This year, Mind That Bird and Rachel Alexandra have provided flickers of excitement, but there hasn't been a Triple Crown winner in more than 30 years. In the meantime, jockeys will take the reins, step into the spotlight, and give fans a new reason to cheer. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, we have come on a Friday to that point in the week's news cycle where we say goodbye to the headlines and the lead stories and instead see what Brendan Noonan, Enrico Galliano, and select members of the Marketplace staff can come up with.
George Judson, Managing Editor of Marketplace. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The swine flu vaccine shortages in Canada.
I thought the Canadian health system was perfect.
It is if you're a hockey player.
What's going on?
Well, on the one hand, some people are standing in line for hours. On the other hand, a healthcare worker was fired for giving preferential treatment to a professional hockey team.
That sounds outrageous, but, you know, hockey players don't use the dental system in Canada, so maybe they get first dibs on the vaccine.
Well, they're bigger, too.
Jeremy Hobson, New York reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The new frontier, Rico, the Galactic Suite Space Resort Hotel, offering a number of rooms at discount rates, will be available starting in 2012.
This is a hotel in space.
Just $4.5 million for a three-night stay.
And the coin-op vibrating bed takes $1,000 bills only.
Yes, it's actually going to accept all universal currencies. But Rico, the hotel staff's sort of out there.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What's your story?
Well, Mindset Media just did a bunch of research on beer.
I've been doing research on beer for a decade.
Right, but their research focuses on like what a beer says about a person. For example, Bud drinkers are more likely to drive a truck. Heineken drinkers are more likely to drive sports cars. And craft beer drinkers are more likely to watch The Office.
Wow.
So, Brandon, I guess the question is, what kind of beer do you drink?
Actually, it's red wine. And it says I work for public radio.
That is just a taste of what Brendan and Rico can do. Get the full meal on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that on a Friday afternoon is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 17 points, a 10th percent, despite that unemployment report. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, a 3rd percent. The S&P 500 added 2 points, a quarter of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you know, credit cards are changing their terms left and right, but you can set some terms of your own.
Don't pay to have a good credit score, i.e. don't pay interest if you don't have to. Don't pay annual fees if you don't have to.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is back here Monday afternoon, same time, same channel. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.